My name's Jonathan Frerix, and I work for the ELCA overseas, at present in the Middle East, in Cyprus. And as I said yesterday, climbing mountains that happen to be nearby is sort of a hobby that I enjoy. And we lived for 9 years in Geneva, working at the Lutheran World Federation. And Mont Blanc is about an hour's drive from Geneva. You can see it. We could see it from our balcony when the weather is clear. There is a little mountain in between Mont Blanc and Geneva that has a nice point on it, and it's known as the Japanese Mont Blanc. I don't want to be hard on the Japanese here, because I made a little fun of them yesterday too, but the reason it has that name is because often there's too much cloud to see Mont Blanc from Geneva. So they see this little thing, which is actually called the Mole, and it's about, the French name is the Mole, and it's about 6,500 feet, but it has a nice summit, and you see them taking pictures, and all tourists do this. They stand there and their friends take pictures of them with the mole behind them. And you can hear them sometimes talking about how it's great they got a picture of their friend with Mont Blanc in the background. But the real Mont Blanc has a little bit more going for it than the mole. Again, a word about the early history of the place. I want to talk about the mountain for a little bit, talk about the first time it was climbed and the 200-year commemoration of the first time it was climbed, and then talk about the present state of alpinism in the Alps, and there's where the slides come in. The mountain itself is related to the business we know about the shifting of the continents. I think some of you know that Italy is really not part of Europe, it's part of Africa. Italy is on the African plate. And even as Italy looks sort of like something thrusting up into the belly of Europe, it's the African plate thrusting up into the plate that Europe is on. And where it hits, you have the Alps. The Alps are being pushed up as the African plate crunches into the European plate. And you can see that almost anywhere you go in the Alps, because the northern slope of the mountains is often like this, and the southern slope is like this. So here's Africa coming in, and it's shoving underneath Europe. And so it buckles the strata up like that, and you often see the strata in the Alps doing this. And you'll see one of the slides, you'll see a great example of that in the slides we show. What this means for mountaineers is that the easy routes, it's not always true, because you know about the north slope of the Eiger, the north face of the Eiger. But the easy routes are often here, and that's certainly the case on Mont Blanc on the north side, and some of the very tough routes are on the south side. But the south side gets more sun, and so they aren't necessarily as tough as some of those icy northern routes. The mountain itself, I don't have a good picture of it, unfortunately, so I just want to draw you a little one. Show a few of the points we're going to talk about. There's a feature here, and then something like this, and the summit is like that, and it goes down. And then I'll condense this a little bit. There's a few bumps, and and it goes off here. This one's more pronounced, actually. The top of it is 4,607 meters, I think. Roughly 16,000 feet. I no longer think in feet. I've been overseas too long. But I'll give you rough equivalents to the rest of the world thinks of their mountains in meters, not in feet. So that's sort of part of the deal. There's a bar of rocks here, and a bar of rocks here. There's a tongue of rock coming up from the valley from Chamonix. Here is a bar of rocks here that we want to talk about. The village of Chamonix is here. You've heard of that. I think they had the Winter Olympics there once. There's a tunnel here above Chamonix, a tunnel through the mountain, because on the other side of the mountain is Italy. And you go through a 13-mile-long tunnel, and you come out in Italy. And you get to that tunnel. You can see the opening of it right above of Chamonix, and when the European truckers want to make a demonstration and screw up the traffic flow, all they do is block this tunnel. They've done a lot.
Where are they starting from? You said the end in Italy. I came in late.
Sorry, this is France.
France.
Yeah, sorry, Mont Blanc is in France. The French did something back when they drew the borders, because quite often borders go along with the watershed, so you might be able to expect it to come over the top, because Italy isn't far away, but they got the whole, most of the whole top of Mont Blanc.
Is that where the Basque
France.
People live?
Basque? No, that's in northern Spain.
Spain and France, yeah.
Between the Pyrenees, yeah. Here is an area that we will mention. It's called the Grand Plateau, which means just what it says in English too. And then coming from the Grand Plateau, there's a big glacier sort of coming down towards Chamonix, and it hits this barrier of rock and sort of splashes the way glaciers do. And that's called the Bosson. And in medieval times, this glacier threatened the village, and some other glaciers threatened the village of Chamonix. There's a hut here called the Grand Mulet, and there's another hut here, and there's a little tiny refuge here that you can squeeze into. Just one or two other things. Have any of you been to Chamonix? Did you take this lift up here to Aiguille de Midi? Okay, it's the highest lift in Europe. And it goes up to 4,000 meters. So it goes up to, what is that, 13,000 plus feet. And, we could spend a whole hour talking about this, because from here, you get out of the lift, you walk through a little tunnel in the top, and in front of you is what's called the Vallée Blanche, the White Valley. And it's a huge glacier that is sort of in the heart of the mountain and curves around for about 15 miles and ends up bringing you back towards Chamonix. And you can ski it. And you can make a day out of skiing it. You can stop for lunch, you can stop for morning coffee, you can stop for afternoon coffee. Depends on how long you take to ski. But this is also, I keep running into the Japanese. We went there to ski it one day, and we were in line at 5 o'clock in the morning. The lift opened at 6. The gondolas started leaving. They take 70 people at a time. At 7 o'clock, it cost you about $40 to get up there in the gondola. And we left our place in line. When we came back, they had sent two gondolas of skiers away. And the next 25 gondolas were booked. And we said, excuse us, but we've been here since 5 o'clock. They said, sorry, you went away to get coffee. The 25 gondolas were taken by Japanese honeymooners. So we sat in Chamonix, and it had been a beautiful day. And weather is the reason why you only do this sometimes. We sat in Chamonix until noon, until those 70 times 25 people, Japanese honeymooners on a big package tour of Europe, had done their thing, gone up there, had a look, and come back. And we got in gondola number 26 and started skiing at noon instead of at 6 or 7 in the morning, and had a sort of a, you know, not so nice ski because the clouds had come down. And there are crevasses, and the joke is always told of this, or it's supposed to be a true story, of one party who lost a member of their party on this ski, fell into a crevasse. They had a guide with them. You should take a guide on this ski. And the guide had his rope and everything, and he let the rope down into a crevasse and shouted down, okay, ready, and pulled him up, and another guy came up. The story is that when the first guy fell in there, he found somebody else down there, and he'd fallen in earlier the same morning, and they agreed among them that since the other guy had been in there longer, he should go back in the same up. Not so far from the truth, because with this kind of a lift, and there's another lift that goes up here, if you want to cheat and climb Mont Blanc from a higher point, there's a lift here that takes you to I think 2,700 meters or something. A lot of people get very high, and there's a lot of plateau area up here. And so you have a lot of people not equipped for high altitude who are at high altitude, and they reckon that about 100 people die every year from tourists, not from climbers necessarily, because they're out where they shouldn't be. and they fall into the crevasses up in this area. So that's a little tiny look at Mont Blanc. It's a big hump of a mountain. There's not much around it that goes up quite that high. Our route went something like this. We left from where the, I think we parked at a switchback here, just above the town. The town's at about, I think it's at 3,500. 3,300. And our route was, you zigzag up a lot here, and then you go across and you get on the glacier, and you sort of work way around the glacier, and you end up at this hut. And then you spend the night, and then you leave again early in the morning, not 12:30 like Kilimanjaro though, 3 o'clock will do, 4 o'clock will do, 2 o'clock is good, the earlier the better. And you set off and you wake way across the glacier again, and you come out here and it's some steep stuff, and you get to the Grand Plateau. And then you work your way up various ways here, and you get out, and then you start the sort of summit ridge. I think that refuge is a bit lower. And you go like this along the crest, and you get to the top. So later on you'll hear a bit more about those things.
So Chamonix is at 3,500
feet. Feet, yeah, it's at 1,000 meters, roughly. I should be clear. Should we stick with meters?
Yeah.
Let's start our European education here. So you're going from 1,000 meters to 4,600 meters. Multiplied by 3.3, or 3.1. to get feet. You'll find out. It's a two day thing.
Did you have you said the same route?
Yeah, we did. I should mention too. John and Ruth here have said something. There's a route. This is really Holden Village stuff now. There's a route around Chamonix, around Mont Blanc, around the whole massif, the whole huge feature. That takes you 10 days. And you go through three countries. You go through France, Italy, and Switzerland, because they all come close to the mountain. And it's a wonderful route. I think the highest point is about 3,000 meters, so it's about 10,000 feet. And there's some real passes to get over, and you see the mountain from every possible angle, and you get to compare the French hospitality with the Italian hospitality with the Swiss hospitality, and you get to compare the French cows with the Italian cows with the Swiss cows, and the French rangers with the Swiss rangers, and the French helicopters with the Italian helicopters. And it makes a wonderful walk. I've done parts of it as other walks, but never the whole thing, and it's something that's well within the range of anybody who's a little bit fit and willing to take their time on good paths. Now, this mountain was first climbed 206 years ago, on 7th and 8th of August, 1786. So just before the Continental Congress, 1789, after the Declaration of Independence, right in that period when we were starting to become a nation, it was climbed by two people from Chamonix, a trapper and a doctor. The trapper was named Balma, and the doctor was named Pacquart. And there were a lot of people trying to climb it that summer and previous the summers just before that, but these two were the ones who finally made it. And we happened to be living in Geneva when the 200th anniversary came along. And I've got here a newspaper from La Suisse, the main newspaper in Geneva, and the headline story is not a picture of Balma and Pacquart, but a picture of a guy named Saussure, who was a famous Geneva man of letters and scientist, all-rounder, who climbed it the next year, and who had given a prize, set a prize out for anybody who could climb it. He paid the prize to Balma and Pacquart. And I'll pass this around, and you can see it's an etching or a drawing kept at the Swiss Alpine Club in Geneva of his party. It says, the climb of Saussure of Mont Blanc in August 1787 with his valet and 18 guides. And what's interesting about it is that the only alpine equipment that they used was a stick with an iron point on it. One guy here is carrying a ladder, just a regular carpenter's ladder. He took it from, chalet number 8. And imagine going across glaciers and things with your, whatever boots were like in those days. They probably had some nails sticking out. I don't know, or that was a later development. But anyway, there's one item. I'll pass that around separately. And then the second one, here's a picture of Mont Blanc. And it doesn't quite, you know, they don't quite agree with mine. I don't know what's wrong here. But you'll see, I'll put a little mark on it. You'll see this place where you can take the lift to, Aiguille du Midi. There's a little arrow there. That's that highest lift in Europe where you can go and fall in a crevasse and find somebody else. And you'll see the summit. And as they commemorated it, they took two guides on the 200th anniversary. And you know, Europe is real big on commemorations. They got a lot to commemorate, and they live sort of in the cycle of commemoration. Two Chamonix guides dressed up like Paccard and Balmain, exactly, right down to the pointed stick, you know, and the leggings and the felt hats. And they climbed it on the exact same route of those two, keeping the same time, so they arrived at the summit at 8:23 in the evening, like the original. And we were on the mountain the same day, sort of watching them do it. So I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. But here's two pictures of these two present-day guides dressed in the mountaineering gear of the period. And I think we should also note that, you know, mountains like this weren't climbed much at that point. This was a new thing to do that. And this stands out back in 1786 as sort of unusual. I don't know what happened. The French Revolution came 3 years later, and other things happened. But the real opening up of the Alps to Western style, to the inhabitants of climbing them or other people coming to climb them, didn't really happen until almost 100 years later. And it wasn't the French who did it. It was the English. This is a case where the English can take the credit and deserve it. You might have heard of Edward Whymper, the fellow who first climbed the Matterhorn in 1865. He and some other British, he was an artist. He went there to paint the Alps, but he got so interested in painting them that he started climbing them. And he ended up being the first man to climb the Matterhorn. But the British really opened up the Alps for mountaineering in the last three or four decades of the last century. And it's been going on ever since. And the last real, real tough things were climbed for the first time in, say, the early 50s, the late 40s. You know the story, perhaps, of the Eiger, the north wall of the Eiger that was first climbed in 1937. And it's still a fairly big deal to do it. There's new routes being opened up, but there's a great story to read. If you want to read a good book, read Whymper's book called Scrambles Amongst the Alps. And you hear about a guy wearing stuff like that who makes us just look like pansies. I mean, he would spend the night in a cave with water dripping down his back, you know, nothing waterproof except perhaps wool, you know, which isn't really waterproof, is it? I don't know what they use for rain cover. And in his diary, he'd write, well, we spent an uncomfortable night. And then the next day, they'd go and climb a 16,000-foot peak for the first time, you know. And they'd be out for days like this, and supply, and where do you start from? The approach marches, all those kind of things are really a different smoke than what we're used to. I wrote a little story about climbing Mont Blanc, and I'm going to read that to you. And I'll pass around some more pictures. You'll see a picture of Yves, the fellow that was with me that day. You'll see these two guys who are in the newspaper. You can pretty much sort it out. You'll see French television filming them as they climb right up here on the Grand Plateau. This picture of the helicopter is at about 3,800 meters. You'll see their hat and their gloves and a Coke can. You'll see them carrying a big wooden object, and that's a barometer, because somehow Balmain had to carry a barometer that was about this long and weighed about 10 pounds to sort of prove the altitude. Remember, they had no idea how high it really was, I think. Maybe they'd done some triangulation. This is a picture from the Bosson glacier. You'll see some of the formations on the glacier. There's a picture of myself at the top. These are both taken at the top. We're looking a little frosty. And that night, the French army had strung This wasn't actually Bauman Packard's route. They came up here on this promontory of rock, and then they went out here, like this. The French army strung sort of incendiary torches with a wire to detonate them on this 200th anniversary. And as the finale of the evening celebration in Chamonix, after all the fireworks down in the valley and all of the dancing and parades and music and everything, they pulled the plug on this chain of torches, and it went right all the way up the mountain. It took about 3 or 4 minutes. And here you see it burning. But the problem with it was that the mountain decided that it wasn't going to celebrate the 200th anniversary. And there were clouds here all day long. We'd been in them that morning. And we had now, we could see this far at the top. I mean, you could sort of see your friend if you looked closely. And the whole top of the mountain, above about 4,000 meters, never left the clouds all day. So here you see a big flare, and it's actually this chain of light going up into the clouds and disappearing for a while. And then they had a big bomb at the top or something. And Carol the Ranger wouldn't have liked it at all. That went off, and the whole cloud lit up, and you see it here lighting. So some pictures for you to look at, take your time while I read this little story about climbing it. In the late 18th century, scientists and romantics in Europe took new interest in high mountains. The Alpine heights were seen as laboratories for the forces of nature. Their valleys gained some of their present-day renown as idyllic places of fresh air, forest, and Alp. In the Dukedom of Savoy, this was before France existed this far out, so it was just the country of Savoy. In the mountain village of Chamonix, life began to change as a result of this interest. Two hotels were built in the 1770s along a road into the valley. More travelers came to visit, from England, France, and Geneva. The young Johann Wolfgang von Goethe was one who passed through, and he described the blue skies, peaks, and cloud formations as a veritable feast for his eyes. Chamonix lay at the foot of the highest mountain in Europe, a mountain known as the Mont Maudit, which means accursed or devil mountain. But the attitude behind the name was clearly changing. In the 1770s, a gentleman scientist from nearby Geneva, Horace Benedict de Saussure, the guy on the front page of the newspaper, offered a reward to the first person to climb what was also becoming known as Mont Blanc, which stands for Mount White, White Mountain. During the summer of 1786, various attempts by Chamonix people and others continued, as in previous years. Then, two locals, a chamois hunter and crystal gatherer named Jacques Balma, and the village doctor, Michel Gabriel Paccard, planned an attempt together. Bad weather in midsummer delayed them until August 7th. On August 7th, 200 years later, we were looking down on Chamonix from the steep north flank of Mont Blanc. After 2 hours, my climbing partner and I had reached the height where valley sounds fade away, but where one can still see much detail in the valley below. We watched the crowds gathering as if for a marathon along a route from the village church to the base of the famous mountain. They were gathering for a reenactment of the first descent by two Chamonix guides, sporting the laced cuffs and meager climbing gear of 1786. The real Balma and Paccard had also started in mid-afternoon like this, but not with cheering crowds. Each had left secretly from his own side of the village to avoid alerting any possible competitors. Helicopters shuttled up and down the mountainside all afternoon. One appeared to leave with the reenactment exactly at 3 o'clock when the guides left, climbed rapidly, passing near us, maybe tracing the historic route, filming it, perhaps. In fact, 5,000 feet high, 10,000 feet high, and finally all the way to the top of the mountain, some 13,000 feet above the village. It paused a moment, then came back
down. It took only about 20 minutes for the round trip
by air. Balma and Paccard had taken 30 hours to reach the top. At high noon that day, our own first descent had begun while we were still on the highway. Climbers used to have to walk to a mountain before climbing it. Now they usually drive, at least part of the way. But whenever one first sees the chosen mountain, an element of the approach march is retained. From inside our moving car, some 14,000 feet below on the freeway, we could already see the summit ridge of Mont Blanc. Up there, clearly visible in the snow, was a path heading for the top. It was like recognizing something on the moon, an unexpected detail, seen at great distance. We stopped to have a better look, saying to each other that we would be up there by this time tomorrow morning. At that moment, we had just begun to leave our everyday lives behind. After seeing our goal and entering unnoticed the compressed but slower time zone of mountain climbing, the pace of everyday life still flowed around us, however, right up to and even through the mountain. A truck carrying $1 million worth of red Ferraris roared by, fresh from Italy, coming this way from Italy, from the factory, via the Mont Blanc tunnel, probably bringing them to Geneva to be sold. We left our car near the mouth of the tunnel to Italy and continued on foot, zigzagging up the slope above the village to a height of about 6,500 feet before turning towards the summer ice on our right, towards the glacier. Here was the Bosson Glacier, which would take us, like the first climbers, almost to the top. While we stopped to prepare ourselves, I counted the returning climbers as a measure of the mountain's popularity on the eve of its anniversary. 20 people came off the glacier during the time we took with our crampons and ropes. One man told us it was dangerous to sit where we were sitting because of falling rocks. It was a reminder that, although our route was not particularly dangerous, even it had claimed a share of the 6,000 people who have died on Mont Blanc in these past 200 years. At some places out on the glacier, we could hear crisp noises coming from deep inside. These did not fit with the glacier's surface appearance, which was mute and messy, as if a dirty mountain basin had been drained long ago and all the debris was left stranded on the ice or in it. The glacier looked as if it had once been active, obviously able to have made such a mess, but that now it was only melting. Periodically, through the 17th and 18th centuries, before the mountains were first scaled, this glacier and the others of Chamonix were actually on the rampage. At one time, the threat was so bad that the Bishop of Geneva was brought to exorcise the glaciers. At other times, lesser holy men had blessed these frozen intruders to keep them back from the hamlet and its pastures. The noise we had heard seemed like a sign of both life and time. It was a running water, of course, and what was more, meltwater, which had only been water again for a little while. Meltwater from when? Surely we were walking on something which had been here for Balma and Paccar. Rocks, yes, but they link one to the distant past. Frozen water is more specific to a recent time, something coming back to life. Maybe some of what we were hearing fell as snow 200 years ago. The ice began to get rougher. Ahead and just to the right of our course, we sighted a peninsula of rock jutting up from the valley. This was the Montagne de la Côte, mountain of the side, sort of, the last piece of the mainland below. Here was the jumping off place for the early attempts. Here was where Balma and Paccard had slept and where the two Chamonix guides would sleep that night. Balma and Paccard came to there and waited, and then they started the next morning for the top. Around this rocky headland, the sea of ice is always stormy. The rock stands against the tide, breaking and twisting all the ice that ages have sent its way. The scene is one of frozen cause and effect. An 18th century visitor called it an ancient empire of chaos. We were already deep inside this empire and past the headland of that point, working our way higher and deeper towards an island of rock at 10,000 feet. Atop the rock, perched like a squat lighthouse, was our goal, an alpine club hut where we would spend the night, or part of it at least. At 2:15 the next morning, I looked down from the club hut on several strings of fireflies moving slowly up the mountain, small lights weakly stabbing the ice. They were rope teams of climbers who had risen at the recommended time for an early start. At 3:23, we were in their tracks. My partner Eve's new batteries were somehow flat, so whenever we crossed the crevasse, I shined my headlamp back for him. Otherwise, he made do with the night, including the slight illumination from the towns in the valley below. He said it was more tiring than dark without a light. We soon met some lights coming down, Austrians who had started early, but, having just arrived the day before, now found themselves too high too soon. They said they would try again tomorrow. Through these small hours, a steady surge of mental energy accompanied the climbing rhythm. I decided to memorize the train of thought using the alphabet. A was for the altitude-sick Austrians. B was for bandits, time bandits. For the Austrians in too much of a hurry, and for us so conscious of time. We both had to get back and work the next day, I think. We had finally decided that we could not join in the reenactment. We would not follow any of the historic route at the historic pace. It would simply take too long to climb it the way they climbed it 200 years ago. First, we had thought we'd leave Chamonix with the two guides and go all the way. Then we thought we would intercept and join them in these early morning hours of August 8th as they passed our hut. But then we heard that they would not reach the summit until 8:23 in the evening, like Balma and Paccard 200 years ago. So we decided to just climb Mont Blanc on this historic day, but on a modern schedule. We would wait for them on the Grand Plateau at 13,000 feet on our way back down. C was for all the crevasses we avoided, especially the ones big enough to swallow semi-traders. It was also for the lights of Chamonix and for the corruption of O Shenandoah, I long to see you, which I sang in the dark using the name of the town below me, so it was O Chamonix, I long to see you. D was for dormir, which is sleep in French, the extra hour of sleep we took before starting. It must have helped because we both felt great. E was for the modern era, which includes so much that crowds out, time. In our case, the jobs, the money, and the mobility to dash off to the mountains, the equipment to travel light, the high alpine huts with wardens, which obviate camping and tents and extra food. F was for my footsteps, which sometimes fell too fast. I had to try to keep a pace, which I felt I could keep all day. G was for God, who made the night around us. The people in the towns below us were somehow needlessly displacing too much of the night. There were so many lights still. Tonight, to celebrate the bicentennial, the whole mountain would be illuminated. First, fireworks on all flanks, and then a line of torches would burn like a giant fuse, lighting the historic route up the mountain all the way to the top. We had to hurry back to Chamonix to see the spectacle. 4:40 a.m. We met a group of four descending. They said it was blowing and snowing up higher, and that it was wise for them to turn back. Their tone of voice implied that it might be wise for us to turn back too, but we continued thinking that the weather would improve by the time we got higher. Maybe our late start would help us in the end. 3:23 being a late start from the hut. 6:20 a.m. on the Grand Plateau, the place here, where it's sort of flat, there's sort of a lap in the mountain. Another rope team of four climbers retreating, citing the cold wind and the altitude. As the leader spoke, the third man stepped off the track and vomited numbly. I don't know how you can vomit numbly, but that's what I thought it was. It was about here that Balma had wanted badly to turn back. He had left his three-week-old daughter at home, very sick. Dr. Paccard, who probably delivered the child, persuaded him to continue. Paccard then began taking his turn at making the track and even took some of Balma's load, which included a meter-long barometer in a wooden case. Balma's instincts were correct, it turned out, because his infant daughter died during that day while he was climbing. Ahead and to the left, above the Grand Plateau, lay two bars of rock, and between them the original route to the summit. These two bars that don't get covered by snow. We would not go that way because of the danger from icefall. A better route went to the right, up a safer slope, and joined the long northwesterly summit ridge. It was hard to imagine why Balma and Paccard did not go that way, or the Geneva professor, Saussure, in his successful attempt 1 year later. Indeed, the guidebook attributes this route to a much later date, an expedition of 1859. Today it's the main route. Whether you take the lift and join it here, or do this thing and join it there, it's the main route for the tourist climbers. Who knows how much more difficult it was to be first? One already had enough to do, accepting so many unknowns, persisting and enduring. Jacques Balma had certainly shown his mettle earlier in that summer of 1786. Returning from one climb, he had met another party just starting out and was invited to join them. He went home for provisions and started back up at 11 o'clock at night, catching up with the party atop the Montagne de la Côte at 2 in the morning and continuing on. So he was down here, grabbed his stuff, left at 11 o'clock at night, caught him here, which is probably 10,000 feet, and kept on going. Later that day, probably within 2,000 feet of the summit, he went on alone to reconnoiter, and when he returned, he found that his comrades had gone back without him. Sounds like a great party. Instead of following them down, he took courage to go back up, in his own words, according to his diary. Getting high enough to look over into what is now Italy and possibly finding the way he and Paccard would later take. The summit remained blocked in cloud, and he descended to the Grand Plateau, where he met both the night and a huge crevasse which he could not cross in the dark. He climbed back up to the shelter of some rocks and spent the night without cover at an altitude of 13,000 feet, a special kind of mountaineering first. All night long he rubbed his hands and stamped his feet while his clothes and hair froze. The next morning he was still interested in the summit, he said, but he gave up when the sun did not burn off the cloud. Cloud was not to lift on the anniversary day either. Mont Blanc kept its summit to itself and to those who approached it on foot. Kept the helicopters away, at least. Above 13,000 feet, we climbed in a cold, gray, and featureless world. So from about here, we didn't see anything anymore. It was just, you know, being in the clouds. With the cloud came a stiffening wind, just strong enough to sharpen the long summit ridge. It blew from our right, where the biggest of the two drop-offs, there's one on either side of the ridge, was invisible in the mist. In the final 2 hours of our ascent, I counted 70 people coming down from the top. 70. This was almost the number of visitors Chamonix received in a whole season 200 years ago down in the valley. We usually passed with only a grunt of greeting in one language or another. The 47th person said on passing, "Nous avons eu un accident," in German-accented French. When you're climbing in the Alps, the first language is always the language of the part you're climbing in. So there, you know, if you can speak any French, you sort of greet people in French. And this German said this in French. But we've had an accident. But it wasn't clear what kind of accident he had had or they had had. The 56th person was an Englishman from Suffolk, a fitting type given the English place in Alpine history. We did not see any of the more recent visitors, Americans or Japanese, but overtook a lone Italian who asked us if we had seen his partner anywhere in the fog. We did not know if we had seen his partner. The 67th person was another solo, a Swiss German perhaps, who asked if he could wait below and join our rope to cross the glacier on the way back down. I was sorry to be walking blind, though I knew where we were from the view from our balcony in Switzerland, 50 miles away. Mont Blanc sits like a great crooked throne, obliquely facing Chamonix and points north, offering the silhouette by which it is best known. The one in the paper is virtually that one. A supporting cast of rocky points and snowy domes rise to support the summit, yet give it pride of place. This is the view on the postcard sold from Chamonix to Geneva and beyond. We were definitely close to the top. The red, white, and blue strap on my ice axe snapped like a flag in the wind. A wind like this somewhere up here had blown Paccard's hat off 200 years before. The track was mostly brittle ice, crushed by all the crampons into something like what you would put around a bottle of champagne. I tried to remember such details with another memory aid. This time it was going to be small a, small b, but it didn't work. Nothing was as interesting as before, and my memory seemed to be a bit weak at that point. And altitude sickness starts to come into effect here, I think. So from here on, the article is sick. When we reached the summit, there was only more of the misty void. The track kept right on going over the top and down towards Italy. The top of Europe is an arced ridge, not a pinnacle, so there is no exact point on which to stand. We photographed each other, taking care that there was nothing untoward in the background, such as the three tents off to one side, which were presumably related to the festivities. You got to make it look like you're the only one up there, right? A few people by the tents, also related to the festivities, it seemed, took no notice of two more climbers, and we did not talk to them. We huddled briefly behind a snowbank, as if we had to experience the moment for a while, but there was really nothing much to do except to go back down. All told, we spent 12 minutes on the top, after 12 hours of climbing time from Chamonix. The world was waiting at the bottom, when we got back, down to the glacial shelf called the Grand Plateau. 24 French television people had already arrived by helicopters to set up for the live news report from Mont Blanc on the 1 o'clock news back in Paris. Noon, you know. They were ready for a star climber, a famous mountaineering author, and a weatherman. Had all those people with him, a reporter, and of course the two guides from Chamonix who were dressed up like Baumart and Paccard. Till then, on that bicentennial day, this busy mountain had had the space to let us and many others observe the bicentennial with relative dignity. It was, nevertheless, an ironic occasion. We were commemorating a brave and solitary deed, but also a violation of sorts, the first of many such, and therefore somehow saddening, the first time this mountain had been submitted to what it was going to get a lot more of. Still, I felt the mountain had easily held its own. As we climbed into its realm of space and time, space had grown and time had slowed and fallen away, unsuited, perhaps, for the exertion. The mountain filled in our footsteps as we went up. We knew that to descend was to re-enter, and at the Grand Plateau we came upon a sudden re-entry. We could have had a gentler ending if we had walked right past the television cameras. But the mood on this part of the mountain was interesting. A helicopter landed, a photographer from the magazine Paris Match, you might have seen that magazine sometime, jumped out and he ran over to take our pictures. He was attracted by the frost in our hair and beards. I took his picture in return. We learned that for the noontime television audience, the star climber was to have jumped from the top of Mont Blanc with a parasail, but the day was too windy and too cloudy. We talked to the guides who were doing Packard and Balma, and they were having a hard time keeping warm in their 1786 clothes. For the interlude, they had put on modern parkas against the wind that swept down from the summit. A TV personality looked over his notes, a weatherman posed by his colorful computer map of France. Meanwhile, the French army came by, wiring the climbing route with this evening's torches. Our first ascent was somehow over. We were still at 13,000 feet, but it sort of was finished. Whether commemoration, as we had meant, or violation, as some of all this mountain traffic must be, our moment was over, but here was the outside world still trying to have its moment, with television bandits waiting 2.5 miles high to ambush a couple of mountain travelers from the 18th century. They had the guys go down and walk up this one stretch about 16 times to get a good picture of them, you know. We decided to wait with them and watch for a while. That evening, when we reached Chamonix, we found the valley full of people. Some 200,000 people had come for the bicentennial from throughout the region. They had special trains from Geneva and everything. When night fell, fireworks lifted the night in a sound and light climax to the celebration, from the church steeple in the village square, from ski gondolas moving in the dark, from the skyline overhead, and then from helicopters higher still, Mont Blanc was honored with flares, rockets, and music. Then the line of torches was lit along the route of the first climb. The fires scaled the rocky peninsula sticking up there, picked their way across the crevasses and the seracs of the Bossong Glacier, disappeared over the edge of the Grand Plateau, and then came back into view, turning upwards again towards the summit ridge. Before the ridge, the torches disappeared, reaching the clouds which were still there, our clouds. It seemed that the fuse had gone out, that this particular commemoration would not reach the top. But after a moment, the whole cloud covering the summit lit up from within as if by lightning. Mont Blanc had been conquered once again. So perhaps a view you see of climbing it today. On a special day, there were extra number of people there, but I think on any weekend day, there would be, you know, several dozen people climbing it. And there's figures of how many people climb it in a year. And the record, in terms of age, I think is 11 months or 12 months old baby. Some people carried up a baby in a backpack, and there was a big to-do in the papers about why on earth anybody would do that. I mean, what did the child get out of it? But that's the youngest person who's been on top of Mont Blanc. Are there any questions or reflections, some of you, on similar places? Or?
Speaking on that, that's a bad idea. We've heard about a lot of babies that have died.
From
exposure.
Cold?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not working. Anything, they don't do anything.
That's right.
They just freeze them.
This is sort of the line that the papers took, but the people who did it, you know, wanted to set a record or something.
How old was the oldest person? Do you have no idea?
I have no idea, but I bet it's in the 70s. This route isn't particularly hard. It's just long, and you know, there's a few places where you could hurt yourself, but.
So how long did it take you to climb, and then how long did it take you to descend?
Well,
the descent was,
I think we left here at about 1, and we got to there at about 6 or something, 6 in time for supper. Then we left at 3:30. We got to the top at about 7 or 8.
A.M.?
Yeah, same day. And then came back down. I think we were back in the village at 3 in the afternoon. But that's a, you know, that's a decent clip, but it's now turned to a thing where people do it to set records. And the record now, and get ready for this, from Chamonix and back to Chamonix in basically tennis shoes, running shoes, 8 hours. Yeah. They're people who are super fit. They've got, you know, they're smaller than me. You need a certain size kind of body to do this. You got to be pretty light, real fit, real wiry. And they just run all the way. 8 hours. It's been done by several people. Yeah, you need, I mean, you can do it by yourself, of course, but you can do anything by yourself as long as you don't fall. I'd like to now show you some slides. The slides come from the Swiss Alpine Club, and just a bit of context for them. You've got here sort of a picture of alpinism in the Alps these days, because you have a band at about this altitude, between say 2,000 and 3,000 meters, where you have a lot of huts. You're not allowed to camp in the Alps. You can camp way up high, or you can camp someplace where nobody sees you, but climbers are supposed to stay in the mountain huts. And there's several around the flanks of any mountain, and you can do virtually any peak in the Alps from a mountain hut. And the mountain huts are run by the Alpine Club. They're owned by each section. We in the Geneva section own 6 huts. One of them was the busiest hut. It had something like 8,000 people in it a year, sleeping in it. It's near Zermatt, in a very busy area where people can get to easily from a lift. Another thing to mention, where there are lifts, there are people. The lifts draw and congregate people, and they abuse the paths in that area, if you like. By the standards that people preach here, it's much, much heavier use of the mountains. And in general, you see many, many more people in the mountains than you do here, because there are many more lifts, many more roads, many more hotels. There are mountain hotels which are private and also almost as high as the Alpine huts. The Alpine huts have people in them who look after you. You can buy supper from them. They keep the place in order. And you sleep in bunk rooms.
And I wish we had more time, because there's great stories
about sleeping in these places. You know, at the time I slept next to a guide, and there were so many people, we each had, I think we had 60 centimeters of mattress each. It was like 3 people on 2 mattresses. This guide was leaving early. He slept with his boots on. He slept with his elbows in my belly. He snored while he was doing it. I didn't sleep at all. And then at about 2 in the morning, the first wave of people gets up and ruins the sleep for everybody else. And so if you think you're going to sleep until 4 or 5 and get a bit of extra sleep, you know, it's sort of a joke. You lie there and just get mad. And they all have wooden clogs. You're not allowed to wear your climbing boots. I don't know how that guide had his boots on, but you're not allowed to wear your climbing boots in the huts. So what they give you is wooden clogs at the entrance. And these wooden clogs on the wooden floors at 2:30 in the morning, right in the passageway behind the wall, that you're the single thickness of wall where your head is, you know. I mean, you never sleep well. You never sleep well. But they do a great service, because they eliminate camping all over the place. And what you basically have is hikers. You have villagers at about 1,000 meters, up to the highest village I know is about 1,700 meters, which is maybe 6,000 feet, 6,500 feet. From the villages, the bottoms of the valleys, up to the huts, you have hikers. And the huts become sort of goals for hikers, because the huts tend to be up there where they're close enough to help the climbers. Above there, you have more serious hikers who do passes and things, and then the climbers. And so you get a different sort of set of people working this region, and a lot of people working this region. And I mentioned the Japanese because you see them a lot too. They come and you can see them. I've been in one hut that was full of Japanese, and it was about 8 hours walk from anywhere. A group had come there and they traipsed in together. They're all wearing the same hat, the same jacket. In a way, sort of easy to make fun of, but in another way, very low impact. Although there's some numbers, but they behave themselves. And that hut was so quiet, I mean, there wasn't anybody shouting, there wasn't anybody screaming, there wasn't anybody putting their feet up on the table. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't any bravado from the group. It was really a peaceful hut, even though it was full of people. So to their credit for that kind of thing. The Alps have been heavily impacted by cows. There's one part in southern Switzerland called the Swiss National Park, and I think it's the only place that hasn't been grazed, or else hasn't been grazed very recently. So you see what the Alps would have looked like without cows. The cows have pushed the tree line down by grazing the higher meadows. And they've also opened up a lot of the lower slopes. And the word Alp means meadow, cow grazing meadow. It means that more than it means the mountains. And you've got cows here, and you've got cows up to about, oh, you'd stop seeing them at about 2,500 meters, roughly. Are there any questions about that? Otherwise, I'll show you these slides, which relate to the Alpine Club. The Alpine Club stresses organized use of the mountains. It takes care of the cabins. It teaches people to lead groups in a certain way, stressing safety and mountain savvy, mountain knowledge. Stressing technique, but not nearly so much, because the group activities, the sort of semi-public group activities, are not that difficult. Or if they're difficult, they're marked as difficult. And although Europe is a lot nicer than the US in terms of liability, there's still a worry about being liable if you invite people you don't know on courses, on expeditions. In the time I was with the Geneva section, they hadn't lost anybody for 20 years, but in the time I was there, they lost 5 people. Almost all from avalanches. If we could pull a few curtains, and then if somebody would switch on for a second. These are pictures taken from a course which was given for people who are candidates to lead groups in the Alpine Club. And it's a winter course, and what you become after this course, if you pass it, is a chef de course in French. Sort of means, it's not really expedition leader, it's like group leader, outing leader. And as I said, safety is a big deal. Can someone hit this light? I think it's over there too. Just try them all, yeah, thanks.
There's one more, two on the same thing.
Well, that's... Okay. I mentioned safety. I've got another picture with the person on this, but it wasn't coming through there. This is the head of a snow shovel. And in winter, you can have we always carried avalanche detectors, which send out the beeps, and receivers, and their senders and receivers. But they say that if you only have a detector and you don't have a shovel, you're just kidding yourself, because you'll never be able to get the person out. So the head of the shovel is used as a cross piece. This is a stake that had a handle of the shovel. This is the handle of another shovel. The two ski poles are put here, and the person, probably the victim's skis, or if you can't find those, your own skis, somebody's skis, you make up a sled and you get a victim down the mountain with this guided by two ski poles and a strong skier in front doing a big snow plow, and you take somebody down the mountain like that. So an example of safety, one of the safety things they tried to impress upon us. This is then setting out from a mountain hotel. This is not an alpine cabin, and you see it's a fairly big place on this course. And we were going up to do 3 different peaks over a period of about 4 days. This guy's an American working as a Swiss mountain guide. After a few hours, we found ourselves on the side of a mountain, And the first exercise was to spend the night in the open. So we had a bit of coffee. Europeans travel with a lot of coffee and a lot of wine, even in the mountains. And there's always time to take, have a cup of coffee. It used to bug me, but then I decided it was an okay. Pardon? Yeah, I should say, these are like downhill skis, but they're a bit lighter, and the boots look like downhill boots, but they're a bit lighter, and the bindings are like downhill bindings, but they're a bit simpler, and the heel can come loose, and you pivot, but without bending the arch of your foot like in cross country. Your foot is locked into a downhill type boot, it's strong enough so that you can pivot off the toe, the whole thing goes up, and you do it with artificial seal skins on the bottom. You can go straight up a mountain. Really good traction. You take off the seal skin, clamp down your heel, and ski down downhill style. The only problem is you've got some weight on your back. And with the lighter boots and the lighter skis and the various snow conditions, you can be a great skier at a ski station, you know, a ski resort. And you get out on this stuff, and you just, you know, want to crawl into a hole and hide because of the way you're skiing. So we started digging our snow shelters for the night. And the people you're seeing in these pictures are mostly the French-speaking group. It was about 40 people on the course, but there are only 7 francophones, that is from the French-speaking minority in Switzerland, about 12% of the population. We had to stick to ourselves, and the French sort of don't ever learn German. The Germans learn French, but the French don't ever learn German. And our instruction, we had a French guide with us, who's a pretty, this guy here, he's a pretty famous. He's done K2 and a whole bunch of stuff in the Himalayas. So we started digging. It took about 3 hours. That's the back of our guide. But you see how much snow there was there. I mean, I don't know how, probably 5-6 meters of snow. We were only at about 9,000 feet, too. The next morning, there'd been some people camped down further, and it turned out it was the Swiss Army. All Swiss males are in the Army until they're 45, and they all have to spend 3 weeks a year doing it. And some of them are designated as mountain troops. You see, they all have the same white skis. They all have the same Army clothes on. They got ropes. And in the morning, the previous melt of the day is all hard and icy, and I was out just looking around a little bit. We weren't ready to go yet. And these guys were all ready. They had rifles on their backs. They were on their skis, and they came rocketing over this icy surface of snow, heading off. They were going to do this, a peak over there somewhere, going to go like this. And it was really impressive to see all these guys squatting down going. There's our sort of village square with various houses going off to the different sides. Had a great night. There's nothing like sleeping in snow. You know.
Was it pretty warm inside?
It's not warm, but it is. But it's not. It's not windy, and it's real quiet, and it's real stable. And once you get yourself warm, you'll be warm. You know, it's just a fantastic way to sleep. We set off then for a mountain. I don't think it's like this, but it's around the corner. And there's somebody's pack and skis ready to go. The Army, are they in this? Yeah, here's the Army. See that chain of men? They're going up here to that point. We kept seeing this little ant-like figures all day long. They're going up there. They make them work, you know. Keep your country free. Just the people ahead of me going, tromping up the hill. The Germans, the other 33 people in the course, they were all in single file. They did all the same switchbacks. They kept together. They all followed their little group leaders, you know. The French-speaking people travel like this. Lower impact on the snow, you know. Don't make so many tracks. I mean, make more tracks, but not so many deep ones. That's a picture taken through the glacier goggles that I was wearing. I just That's what you're looking at, rather than that nice stuff that the camera takes. Because you go blind if you look at this all day without the glasses. There we're getting close to the summit. It's a mountain called Wildstrubel. We didn't go up there on the rocks, we went up to the left of the higher point actually. On snow. And there we're standing around the top. Very pleasant in the sun in the Alps. If it's a sunny day, it's really wonderful. There's no wind.
What would the temperature have been?
Well, probably 40 or something, but the sun feels like 70 or 80, or say 70. There's always a difference. The sun is warm, but the air is cold. You know how it is. Sort of like here. You can see the boots people are wearing. Those are those mountaineering boots.
Jonathan, can I ask, do women not go on these climbs?
Oh, yes. The Alpine Club integrated about 20 years ago, and some of the older members still don't agree with it. But
there are many women on this section?
Yeah, there are. Not in the French group, though. They were all Germans. It's very mixed. Very mixed. Some of the scenery around us, and if I'm not mistaken, this is the Eiger, for what it's worth. And if I'm not mistaken, I may be, this is the back of the Matterhorn. It's an angle you don't usually see from where we were. But that's one of the neat things about the Alps is, once you get to know them, and you work the area that you can reach from Geneva with 1 or 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours driving, you get to be able to pick any peak. And when you fly in airplanes, you can pick any peak. I mean, you really start to feel like you know this set of mountains. That's myself, just to show what a person looks like. And I don't know where I have my hat, but I had my gloves on my head at that point. And this is the avalanche detector. This is the sleeping mat with a rope inside. This is the ice axe, crampons, and a pack that was too heavy. And I wasn't pleased at all with the way I was skiing with all this stuff on my back. Another mountain the next day. We're headed around this corner. We left our snow cave, skied down the valley, and up another two mountains on the other side. This was our goal, and it fell away so steeply. This is that southern slope that's very steep, and the northern slope that is more doable, but in this case, nothing to ski. So we left our skis here, and we walked this ridge to that point. Typical for a mountain skiing or climbing in winter is, you know, you ski part of the way and then you leave your skis and do the rest on foot with your ski poles. So here are some of us going up that, just below the crest of that ridge. And the mountain we were on the day before, this is the big valley of the Rhone. It's called the Valais. It's the biggest canton in Switzerland. This is the central feature of it. It's a very, very deep valley. The mountain we were on the day before is somewhere over in here, I think. That's one of the members. We got to the top, and this guy jumped up and grabbed a rope and stuck in his ice axe and pulled me down and tied me to the mountain because he thought I was being too, unsafe on the top. But he didn't ask me, you know, he's sort of like. Here's our group. As you can see, I'm still having trouble with my hat. This is a dish towel. but that's the French-speaking group. They're really a nice group of guys.